Welcome to the Marty and Laura Show. We're so excited to be joining you. We're here to talk about your dogs, your cats, and maybe even some small critters. Anything you've got a question?
We've got answers for all of it.
The Marty and Laura Show is brought to you by Veterinary Village. With locations throughout Wisconsin, Veterinary Village is dedicated to enhancing the quality of animal and human lives today and into the future.
All right, you guys, welcome to the Marty and Laura Show. We are super excited to have you here today. Marty and I have both been chasing our tails around across the country, and so we're very happy to be back with you this week. And we're going to talk about a topic that I think a lot of people have run into, right? Everybody has, Marty, wouldn't you say cruciate ligament tears are pretty high up on the things that you encounter in your practice?
They are very common. They account for, in Labradors, 5 to 10% of Labradors will end up with a cruciate tear. And there's a lot of variables in that, so we need to kind of parse that out a little bit.
Yeah.
So it makes more sense. Yeah. But that's what the statistics show, is about 5 to 10%. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's going to be different in different breeds. Certain breeds, like greyhounds and corgis, they don't tear cruciates. They're
Interesting.
Just structurally different. Yeah, they're different.
I think that's fascinating. And we talk sometimes in our other podcast and in other places that there are certain things that just kind of go with certain structural, whether it's a breed specific or just the structural specific.
So. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's age of spaying and neutering. Sometimes there's definitely differences within the line of dogs. So there's a lot of variables. I can't just say if you have a Labrador, 10% of them are going to tear a cruciate. There's variables. But that's where this really gets interesting.
Okay, so let's talk about it. First, I want to do a level set so everybody knows we're all on the same page. Let's define what a cruciate ligament is, where it is located, and then we can talk about some of the what happens when the dog tears the ligament, how that happens, things that we can do to help prevent it, and then how we repair it if it does happen.
Sure. And so I just wrote a blog post, so they'll have access to that.
Perfect.
If they're readers, and it'll have links in it and so forth. So let's start with the basic anatomy, and that's that the dog's back leg, their knee, is the part.
If you're watching YouTube, Marty's literally putting her knee on the camera.
Yes. So the knee is the joint in their leg that points forward toward their head. Yeah. Everything else points backwards. Their hock points backward. Their hips point backward. Mm-hmm. But their knee points forward. That's the joint that has cruciates in it. And there are two cruciates. There's a cranial cruciate and a caudal cruciate in dogs and cats. In humans, it's anterior and posterior. So ACL. Mm-hmm. It's anatomically what we call it in people, anterior cruciate. But the exact same ligament in the dog is cranial cruciate because it runs the same direction as the anterior in a person. And so we just don't use anatomical terms that are the same because dogs have heads and tails and people have fronts and backs. So, you know, there's a difference. We don't have tails. Well,
no.
Most of us
no.
don't have tails.
Well, generally speaking. And I think it's really interesting. When I was in high school, had anatomy physiology class. Right. And I was a star pupil in that class because I knew all of the names of the muscles and the nerves and the bones from studying in dog 4-H. So
right.
I know the names are a little bit different, but y'all, it's not that different.
Yeah, not a lot different. Every now and then they change the name a little bit, but in general, anatomically, we're all still pretty much the same. The biggest difference is that dogs walk on their tippy toes and people walk flat footed and only walk on their back feet, not their front feet, because people don't walk on their front feet. Those are called hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I have staff members that'll say, oh, it's her hand or it's her arm. No, dogs don't have arms and dogs don't have hands. They have front legs and back legs. So, you know, to be correct. So the cranial cruciate ligament is, if a ligament is going to tear, it's almost always a cranial cruciate. I don't think I've ever seen a caudal cruciate tear. It's the same joint that has a patella, which is a kneecap, another important anatomical part of the dog that can frequently end up with damage. And in the kneecap, it's supposed to sit in a groove in front of the cruciate ligament, cranial to the cruciate ligament. There's a little groove that sits there, and if the sides of the grooves are too shallow, or if the crust of the tibia that it attaches to is too far rotated to the inner or the outer part of the leg, then that moves the patella out of position. But patellar luxation is important because sometimes that will predispose a dog to a cruciate ligament damage. So they can go hand in hand. but they're typically different. Typically, if you have a dog that's limping because of a patellar ligament, they'll jump down off the couch, they'll pull up their leg, they'll run around the room for 3 minutes, they flex and extend their leg a little bit, and then the patella pops back into place, and then they go charging along back to normal. So people will initially think the dog broke its leg because it's carrying the leg, but the dog isn't crying, the dog isn't painful. They just don't use the leg for a few minutes, and then as soon as it pops back, they're fine. Cruciates are different. Cruciates tend to be a different kind of lameness, either very acute, three-legged that lasts for weeks and weeks and weeks, or a gradual decline in the way they use the back leg to where they eventually come up three-legged lame or incredibly lame, maybe not quite three-legged. So if your dog is three-legged lame and it's persistent, you should seek veterinary care, but you don't have to go in on emergency over a weekend or at night if the dog doesn't have a dangling fracture. Now, if it's a dangling fracture, you need to go in.
Well, that's a
problem. But dogs that tear cruciates, And our answering service is actually run by a guy who started it because his dog tore a cruciate ligament. He went to the emergency clinic and then found out he'd just spent several hundred dollars at the emergency clinic that he didn't need to spend because it was something that wasn't going to be significantly changed enough overnight that he needed to go into ER. So I want people to understand, if you have a dangling fracture, you need to go to the emergency room. If you have a dog that's lame, chronically lame, or acutely lame, but it's not persistent, you can wait until the next time your vet has an appointment and go in.
And one of the things that I kind of associate with a torn cruciate, having witnessed it, sadly, that toe touching, right? Like they won't put weight on the leg, but they're kind of like they want to, but then as soon as they do, they kind of pick it back up again. So I think for a lot of folks, when they first see it, they don't really know what's going on, which is where I think some of the confusion comes.
And there's actually two reasons that that happens, that dogs won't use their leg. One is that it's painful, and people have a misperception of pain because they think if the dog's limping but not crying, that the dog's not in pain. So that's not necessarily the case. The other thing that happens with the cruciate ligament tear is that the joint becomes unstable. So instead of just acting like a hinge joint, it also has a shearing motion back and forth where when they put weight down, the femur shifts off of the tibia. And so that loss of stability of the joint makes the dog not want to use it. So I think it's important that people know the difference between those things and why it's doing what it's doing so that they have a better understanding. And so cruciates are very complicated topics to discuss. It's not going to be, you know, just here, this simple thing is going on. It's much more complicated than that.
If you don't treat it, there can be some additional complications. A dog that I was dealing with had a partial cruciate tear and was being crate rested and stood up to look at a squirrel and blew his meniscus, which is the little squishy part in the middle.
Right. There's two little squishy parts, meniscal cartilages, that are the shock absorbers inside the joint. So if the shearing motion of the joint is bad enough that it goes back and forth and it eventually takes this little disc of cartilage, just one on each side of the head of the tibia, and it turns it into what's called a bucket handle tear. So it's like a little parallel tear that looks like a little bucket handle. So that's why they call it that, is that's how it works. And then it'll flip back and forth inside the joint. Sometimes you'll feel the clicking or the dog will be uncomfortable. So again, there's a reason that the dog doesn't want to use the joint. And we can see cruciate ligaments that just flat out snap. Like it happened to my daughter's Bernese Mountain Dog. She was running around in the house and we knew she was on and off lame, but she wasn't doing anything too bad. And we'd been watching her. And the day that we walked in the door from being out of town, she got super excited to see my daughter and flipped up in the air and came down and boom, tore the cruciate. So you can have a flat out tear. You can have a fray. You can have a partial tear. Eventually a fray or a partial tear is going to turn into a full tear. And so you can see these degradations, these changes inside the cruciate ligament that we don't still fully understand or need to understand better. And we will. But at this point, we don't really have a great understanding of some of these dynamics because there are so many differences. But like back in the old days, when I graduated from vet school and when you had to ride a bicycle to power the x-ray machine because we didn't have electricity, and I'm just kidding, because you didn't have...
back when Davy Crockett was just a boy and dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Exactly. So back in the old days, we used to think that cruciate ruptures were essentially caused by trauma. Like a dog was running out in the field and it caught its leg on a tree stump and it went too far forward and it tore the cruciate. Well, in the last 40 years, we've seen that change significantly to where we've seen these dogs have gradual and progressive lameness. And now we see so many of these dogs with cruciate tears that we started to suspect as a veterinary unit that there was this whole different thing that was happening. And so that's what Dr. Muir at the University of Wisconsin was researching.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I want to talk first, before we go into Dr. Muir's research, which I've read some about and I'm really interested to ask you about. When you take your dog in with this kind of toe-touching sort of intermittent lameness, always going to be in the hind leg, how is your veterinarian going to identify what's going on? Is this an x-ray? It's an ultrasound? It's a palpation? All of the above?
Yeah, it's pretty much all of the above. In general, a veterinary with some experience can generally tell on palpation. So essentially, we want to put the dog in one of two positions, either standing sort of neutrally or laying on its side. And you put one hand on the upper thigh, the femur, and the other hand on the lower part of the leg, the tibia and the fibula, not the second thigh, as some of the show people call it. I just learned that term about a year ago. I feel kind of behind the times. But you put one hand on the upper leg, one hand on the lower leg. So you put your hand on the femur and on the tibia. And instead of just acting as a hinge, it also moves back and forth in a shearing motion, which is what tears the rest of the ligament, which is what tears the meniscus. But essentially what it is, it's such a drawer movement because it moves in and out like a drawer. So instead of acting like a hinge, it's also like a drawer. So that's diagnostic. If you can get a dog's knee to do that without sedation, without x-ray, without anything else, you can tell that that's what the dog has. Now, do we still take x-rays? Absolutely, for a number of reasons. One is we want to see, is this a chronic change or an acute change? So if we can see arthritis already forming, this has been happening for a while. The dog's been tearing a cruciate, fraying the ligament, partial tear for a while. If we're going to do surgery on the dog, we want to know, do they have any other abnormalities? Is the patella in the right place? We'll x-ray the hips oftentimes, not because we think the dog has a hip problem, but because we make that decision, is how bad is your dog's arthritis? How bad is their joint disease already? And is surgery on the cruciate going to make their life a lot better? Or if it's a 14 and a half year old dog that already has terrible hips, should you even put the dog through a surgical procedure when we have other things that can help manage pain? My nephew sent me an x-ray of his dog's hips when we were traveling. And Dan and I were sitting at the airport and I looked at it and I said, gosh, you know, in this position, it looks like the dog's hip is luxated. It couldn't be luxated. He's been walking around like this. And we flipped to the other x-ray. I'm like, oh yeah, it's luxated. His hips were so bad. Oh, wow. His hip joint was flat. It didn't have anything that cupped around the head of the femur. So this dog had very, very, very bad hips and he'd been living like that for 10 years. So at that point, you're going to say, well, the arthritis is pretty bad in this dog. And so maybe they're not going to be successful enough feeling better with a cruciate repair that it's worth doing, because it's an expensive surgery. And there's a number of different procedures, which we can kind of get into. But nevertheless, we take x-rays of the rest. Does the back look okay? Do the hips look okay? What else is going on? You know, what other things do we need to know about? Does this dog have any other serious disease? Before we fixed my daughter's Bernese Mountain Dog's cruciate, I had a full abdominal ultrasound done by our radiologist because she was a seven-year-old Bernese Mountain Dog. And by that age, a lot of them have cancer. So I'm not going to take this dog to a cruciate repair if she's got histiocytic lymphoma or something.
Okay.
I think it's important that we know the dog's entire medical well-being before we make cruciate surgery decisions.
So I guess the other thing I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, a cruciate surgery is not an actual requirement for the dog to live a reasonably normal life, or is it? How do you talk about that?
Yeah, if the dog doesn't have anything done, they're going to be lame for about a month, and then they're gradually going to start to walk better and look better, and all those things are going to improve. And you're going to think, oh, well, my vet was just trying to talk me into a surgical procedure that my dog didn't need. But after about 6 months, the arthritis that develops in that joint becomes pretty severe and debilitating. So like I said, if you have a 14 and a half year old dog with cancer and bad hips, I'm not going to recommend a cruciate repair. If you have a 7 year old athletic dog that's otherwise in good health, I am going to recommend a cruciate repair, even though I know in 6 months they're going to be better. In a year, they're going to be pretty debilitated. So we don't want those things to happen. I'm actually currently managing a little tiny dog, a little 8 pound dog that has so many other health problems that he's on Librela only because fixing his cruciate is not going to change his quality of life. He's got two bad knees. They don't have the kind of money that it takes. So it makes more sense for him to be on Librela because he's a million years old and he's got a lot of other health problems. That really depends on every dog's situation. It's somewhat different, and you need to have a conversation about that with your vet before you jump in and spend $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 fixing that knee. In general, we don't do MRIs diagnostically, but if we have a dog that's got some kind of mysterious lameness, they may recommend an MRI to look for a cruciate or something else. But in general, you can diagnose it without anything really extensive for imaging.
Okay.
However, a number of years ago, I had a client that went down to the university here in Wisconsin with a dog that was lame, and it was a show person. It was somebody that knew that their dog was lame, and it would have been a lameness that was subtle enough that the average person wouldn't have picked it up. But they were really in tune with the dog. They were really good show people, and they identified that there was something wrong. And so this was before CTs and MRIs were a thing, and this was a long time ago. And the vet school said, well, we think we should explore his back. We think it's something in his back. And I said, what? You're going to explore his spinal cord? No. Don't sign up for that, please. That is a terrible idea. And a week later, he tore his cruciate. So we knew at that point that he'd been working on a cruciate rupture. It just hadn't shown up yet as a drawer. So there's some nuances to it. Oftentimes, though, you take the x-ray, you see some arthritic change, and you're like, yeah, this has been cooking for a bit. And he just wasn't telling you how lame he was.
Right.
So there's some really important things. What I think is the most interesting and new thing, though, is that this DNA test now exists.
This is really, really interesting. I want to get into how do we prevent, what are the things that we can do to keep our dogs healthy. But this information and additional information that includes studies that dogs that are spayed or neutered very young tend to have a problem with this. So let's touch on those really quick.
Right. So spaying and neutering definitely has a relationship in a lot of large breed dogs with the severity of which and the likelihood of which they're going to develop cruciate disease. So we know if we spay or neuter dogs before skeletal maturity, which is somewhere between 15 and 18 months, depending on the breed, we're going to increase their risk of torn cruciates. In Labradors, it increases by 20%. So instead of, you know, one in 100 dogs doing this, so it's 20% higher. In Golden Retrievers, it's 400% higher.
Wow.
400%. That's four times the number of Golden Retrievers having a tear cruciate as compared to a Labrador. Why did they do the Labradors? Well, I'm not sure how Dr. Meir picked it, but it makes sense that they did labs because they're pretty athletic dogs and they're very active. And we see a lot of really athletic dogs that are doing field trials and hunting and all those things in Wisconsin. So anyway, that's what he selected. So we know you can reduce your dog's risk of cruciate damage by keeping them fit, keeping them not overweight, keeping them athletically able to be active, putting them on glucosamines, putting them on an appropriate diet, and not spaying and neutering young. So those are things that you can control as a pet owner. Now, if your dog's already spayed and neutered, I can't fix that. I can't put their gonads back.
Right.
But if you have a young dog and your vet is pushing you to do a spay or neuter when they're young, this is a really good reason to say no. And I hate to say something really negative about my profession, but I'm going to right now because veterinarians should be aware that they are increasing the risk of that dog developing a cruciate rupture. Now, if it's a greyhound, like I said, they're not so likely. But if it's a lab, if it's a golden, like if a golden retriever shows up on my surgery schedule at 6 months of age, I call them and cancel the appointment.
Yeah.
I just won't do it. That's how committed I am to this decision is I will do it when your pet reaches skeletal maturity. And that may be, you know, for a male dog, when his testicles get bigger. For a female, it's when she goes through a heat cycle. I'm going to push you out of that surgical spot just because I don't think that ethically it's the right thing for me to do. But a lot of veterinarians know this information and they still want to do spays and neuters young. And I'm going to challenge my profession to say, are some of them really knowing that they're going to put your dog at increased risk of a torn cruciate or some of the other diseases that we won't get into today? Because they know they can make $5,000 on one dog's one knee. And if your dog tears a cruciate on one side, they have a 50% chance of tearing the other one. So now you have a $10,000 procedure. So is your veterinarian knowingly doing that? Or is your veterinarian just not keeping up with the literature or still practicing the way that the practice that they work in is making them just make these decisions? So I'm going to challenge you to push back on your veterinarian and say, I'm not doing this procedure this young because I want my dog to have good knees and all the other things. So we're, like I said, we could go into an hour discussion. That's not the topic that we're doing today.
Doggett simplifies the puppy buying journey by connecting families with the perfect breed and responsible, health-verified breeders. They are the only breeder marketplace that verifies health clearances and responsible breeding practices. Through their personalized puppy matcher tool and matchmaker services, they educate and guide buyers every step of the way, ensuring a seamless process and a perfect match for their lifestyle. From initial breed consultation to introductions with top breeders, Doggett makes responsible puppy ownership easy and stress-free.
So, talk a little bit about Dr. Muir, who's a veterinarian there in Wisconsin, who has discovered a DNA test for a potential to tear a cruciate in Labradors. Is that correct?
Yes, it's got a 62% correlation. And what's really interesting about this test is it's the first complex DNA test that we have for dogs. So it's the one that now tells us about multiple factors that play a role in the dog's likelihood of turning a cruciate. All this before has been things like your dog has a coat for a long coat gene. So you're going to be a fluffy corgi or a normal corgi.
Right.
You're going to have PRA or you're not. You're going to have, you know, some of these very clear cut things. You're going to be Merle or you're not going to be Merle. Well, now we have a test that does multiple genetics. And I don't understand enough about DNA to intelligently discuss it any further than to say, really, you can do that? It's why we don't have tests for things like hip dysplasia and all of other multifactorial things, fertility and all this other stuff that require all these genes and all this environmental things and, you know, diet and environment and how you raise them and all this stuff that we don't have control over. So now we know we can do a test for a disease that has a complex inheritance pattern.
That's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah. So I think this is a breakthrough, not only for cruciates, but for future DNA testing. So that's number one. So number two is you can either DNA test your dog and see how likely they are to other breeds as well. They're looking at, I think, Newfoundlands and Rottweilers are on the list of what's next. I'm kind of surprised it's not Golden Retrievers, but I don't know what they're... But I don't know enough about this to discuss it. But anyway, they're going to be looking at some other breeds, but right now it's just Labradors. So number one, if you already have a Labrador, you can do this DNA test. And if you are at risk, your dog is at risk, not you, you can monitor them and manage them more carefully. You are going to keep their weight even more controlled. You're going to make sure that their diet is appropriate, that they're on a glucosamine, that they're on a diet that's a joint protectant diet, because several companies have this type of diet. Royal Canin has one, Purina has one, Hill's has one. They all have joint protectants in their diet. Just glucosamine, it's anti-inflammatory levels of fatty acids and all these other things that are really cool that they can do. And you may take your dog in periodically for, let's say, once every 2 years, you go in and get an x-ray of their knees. Or let's say that you're just going to go to the vet once a year and have them really carefully go over that dog's joints when you go in. You're not just going to go in and get a vaccination. So that's important. But even more critical than that is before you buy a puppy, if you're going to put a dog in your home that's going to be a field trial dog, a hunt test dog, a dog that you're going to do hunting,
agility,
any kind of performance. Yeah, any performance dog. You could DNA test. Say you want to pick a puppy out of the litter and there's three puppies you really like. You can DNA test those puppies before you buy it. It takes about 4 to 6 weeks to get the test results back. So you could do this before you bought the puppy and pick the puppy that's amazingly powerful. Now, the third thing that you can do with it is you can start to select your breeding stock on that basis. And again, you have to be careful because it's so multifactorial that you could throw out a lot of really good genetics, not just one gene, but throw out a lot of really good genetics in your gene pool by being overzealous in the use of this test. But I think picking the puppy that you want out of a litter, and the test isn't cheap. It's $250 to do the test currently. I'm not sure if that's going to change or not, but it's currently $250 and you can do it yourself. You can just take a cheek swab. You don't have to go to the vet. You can send in a blood sample, but you don't have to. You can do a cheek swab and say you spend $750 before you buy a puppy because you tested three in the litter. Okay, that's not cheap. But if you're going to put a dog into a field trial situation and you're going to spend $100,000 a year on that dog's training, and then you're going to keep it running and you're going to want that dog for your next stud dog or whatever you're planning for this dog.
Sure.
You're going to be in a much better place by making the decision with that piece of information. Should it be the only thing that you pick? No. The dog should have other great qualities. It should be structurally sound. Otherwise, it should be smart. It should have good vision. It should have all the stuff that you need.
That's a really, really interesting tool, both from the people who are breeding dogs perspective and the people who are buying dogs perspective. I have a question for you, and you may or may not know the answer. How do these numbers impact the crossbred dogs? Some of the doodle world, right? How does that come into play or does it?
Well, we don't have any testing on anything other than labs.
Any information. Okay.
If you had a dog that had lab in it, that would be fine. But if you do something like an Australian Labradoodle, labs are one very small component of the genetics of that breed. Even though it says lab in it, it's not largely Labrador. So if you're breeding a lab to a poodle and it's an F1 generation, then yes, there would still be value in that. If it's not, if it's four generations down or Australian Labradoodle or some other component, right now that isn't known to be useful. Could it be in the future? Sure, but we just need to know a lot more than we know now.
Sure. Okay. Really, really interesting. All right. So then final question. It's, you know, go time. You've got to decide whether you're going to do this surgery. I know there's 9 million different ways to do the surgery, which I don't know that we have to discuss, but
good, because I'm not a surgeon.
Yeah. I just think that the important thing for people to know is to give them sort of some parameters and say, you know, if you do this surgery, it's going to cost this much money. It's going to take this amount of time to heal up, mm-hmm. and it will have this ability to live normally after that. So,
right. So there's a number of different procedures. The old way that we used to do this was basically just to imbricate the joint, clean it up, imbricate the joint, tighten it up a little bit, and send the dog merrily on their way. Over the last number of years, the surgical procedure has become much more sophisticated. There are many different options. There's implants. There's all kinds of things. The first thing you need to understand is that we don't sew the little pieces of the cruciate ligament back together inside the joint. There's nothing to sew together. There's nothing that holds. There's nothing that's going to work. That people have tried to run things like Gore-Tex through the joint to simulate the ligament. It doesn't work. So all of the procedures are done on the outside of the joint. They may open the joint and go in and clean up the torn meniscus and the arthritis and some of those things, but they're not suturing these little frayed ends of this tight little band that's snapped off and there's nothing left to put together. So first and basic premise is that you know that. So essentially every other procedure is meant to stabilize the joint so that it goes back to acting as a hinge instead of a shearing motion. Important piece of information.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to do it. There's TTAs and there's TPLOs and there's implants that they can put in. There's all kinds of really interesting things. So I think it's important that two things happen. One is that if you can afford to have a surgeon do this and your dog weighs more than 50 pounds, and this is an athletic dog or a dog that's really active, you pay a surgeon, a board certified surgeon, or somebody with a ton of experience to do a great job of this. I've seen veterinarians who are decent surgeons when it comes to doing spays or lumpectomies or dentals try and fix cruciates and it ends up badly. And you only get one chance to do it well. And if it gets infected in the joint, it's a hot mess. It's very bad. And I've seen dogs have really chronic, life-changing, debilitating, terrible outcomes by not using a surgeon. So you don't want it to be the new person who's just learning to do a new procedure. I was trained by our surgeon to do a couple of them. And I walked away and said, there's just so many things that can go wrong with this. It is not in my wheelhouse. It's orthopedic surgery. And if an orthopedic procedure goes bad, it's really, really bad. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing it. So you have to respect the fact that there are going to be veterinarians that are like, nope, not in my wheelhouse. And that's okay. Go to a surgeon.
Better that they be honest and send you to someone who's very good at it.
Especially if you're running this dog every weekend to do hunting or you're running these athletic events.
Right.
Don't mess with it, man. Pay the extra couple thousand bucks and get it done well by a board certified surgeon that has a 2-chamber surgery room and has all the stuff and all the equipment. And, you know, you can talk to them about which procedure they do. And I don't care if they do a TTA or a TPLO or they do the little wedge implant. I don't care what they do, as long as they've done it a lot and they're really good at it and they can show you that they have really good surgical outcomes. When our surgeon, that we used to have a surgeon that came to the practice, when her husband needed a surgical procedure, she went in with him and interviewed the surgeon and said, how many of these have you done? And what is your complication rate? And tell me about, you know, she was drilling him down on all these questions. And I think that's fair because this is a very important decision that you're making. So it's not just like, oh, well, you know, we're just going to go in and fix it. It's not taking a fatty tumor off that you can do in 15 minutes in the dental suite. We're talking major stuff. It's expensive. So you want it to go really, really well. And there's implants, you know, there's certain things that can go wrong with some of the implants we used to use. They used to use, I say we, like I did it. I never did it. They used to run a wire and sometimes the wire would shear and break.
Yeah,
and so there's been definite advancements in the last 20 or 30 years over how these cruciates get fixed. There's some really cool new things that they're doing. So make sure that you're doing a really cool thing, but if the surgeon doing it is really good at the cool thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's 8 weeks. 12 weeks recovery, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, somewhere in there. It depends on the dog, depends on the procedure. Now, that's what's really cool about the TTAs, TPLOs, and some of these more advanced procedures is they used to be in and bandaged, and they used to be very slow recoveries. And now the recoveries are much faster. They're toe touching the next day, doing really well. Physical therapy post-op also has made the advancements of this improvement much better. These dogs are back on their feet much faster. They're recovering much better. So there's definitely improvements that we've made over the last 20 or 30 years in how this works. But we didn't see this many cruciate ruptures 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. And so that's one of my basic premises is I say to colleagues of mine that do cruciate repairs in general practices that are good friends of mine, I say to them, you know, we just don't see very many cruciates in our practice. And they say, oh, well, you must be missing them. Okay, really? I can tell what a lame dog looks like, man. I can pick that right up, man. I'm pretty quick. So what they don't understand is that so much of what I see in my practice is not spayed or neutered.
Right.
That we almost never see dogs that are intact. I'm not going to say never, but I'm going to say we almost never see dogs that are intact with these cruciate ruptures. We see a lot of these in the dogs that are spayed and neutered young. We see a lot of them in the pit bull terrier type dogs. Mm-hmm. Structurally, those dogs are not like other dogs. Mm-hmm. Part of it is the age they're spayed and neutered at. Part of it is just the way they're made. They don't have much angulation at their knee. Their knee is supposed to have a 45-degree angle. And most, like greyhounds, other breeds, they're pretty strongly angulated. You look at a Rottweiler, a Chow, they're pretty straight. Standard poodles are pretty straight. Yeah. Remarkably, standard poodles Akitas. Don't usually tear their cruciates. Yeah, Akitas.
Really?
Akitas tear their cruciates.
Oh, yeah.
Chows, Rottweilers, Pitbull Terriers are the poster child for this. Those puppies that were neutered at 2 or 3 months of age, and then they end up overweight, and they end up tearing a cruciate, and now you've got a rescue dog that you're now spending $10,000 or $15,000 on.
Right.
It's a big deal. So I do want to just throw in that there are things that you can do that are non-surgical. They're never going to be as good as surgery, and even the most chronic cruciate is going to get better with surgery than it would without surgery.
Right.
But we're still talking about these dogs having a permanent damage to their joint, even with cruciate repair. They're still going to have permanent damage. They're still never going to be that 100% dog that they were before they tore a cruciate. But if you have a dog that's elderly, a dog that has other health problems that doesn't make it a good surgical candidate, you can't afford it. We can put the dog on glucosamines. We can put the dog on anti-inflammatories. Some of the orals are not terribly expensive. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go to one of the injectables like Librela, which we did a segment on, those can make a big difference. And yes, it's $100 a month to do a Librela injection, but in a year, that's $1,200. And if the dog is...
It's still 10% of what you would pay for the surgery.
Right, and if it's an elderly dog, then that's not a bad choice. At least you're giving the dog some good pain management, but you're not putting yourself in a financial position where you've just spent $7,000 on a dog that's going to die in 6 months from something else. So,
right.
These are really hard decisions, but these are the decisions that you need to make with a veterinarian that you trust.
Yeah.
And it may be a veterinarian that doesn't do the surgery because they're probably going to give you a straighter answer than if you go to a board certified surgeon. Because what's a surgeon going to say? Oh, yeah.
I can fix it.
I mean, surgeons
love that. They fix everything. Yes, they do.
Right. A chance to cut is a chance to cure is pretty much what they say.
Yep.
But the surgeon that used to come to our practice, she would evaluate a patient, whether it was a cruciate or something else. She'd do the physical exam. She'd do a complete assessment. She'd sit down at the phone. She'd call the client. And if she didn't think that she could make that dog better surgically, she was sending it home just like it came in the door.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important that you know that there are surgeons out there that are willing to have these conversations and that you choose them well. I don't care if you live in a rural community or a big city, get a good recommendation and find out who's doing these procedures and doing them well, but who you feel like is honest with you to say, yeah, no, this is not a good candidate. I'm not taking your dog to surgery.
We're not doing that. Yeah.
And I just want to say one thing about cats, and that's hardly ever does a cat tear a cruciate. I've seen a very, very, very small number of them.
Well,
most of the time, if it looks like they have a torn cruciate, there's something else going on in the joint besides a cruciate.
Oh, interesting.
But I just don't want to forget our little cat friends that cats generally don't tear.
Fluffy plants.
They're cats.
Okay.
They're cats. They're springy.
They're made out of rubber bands. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. All right. Well, Marty, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your time and your chocolate milk with us today.
Yeah, it's straight up chocolate milk.
Yeah. Marty has a chocolate milk obsession the way some of us have a coffee obsession. Just so you know, that cup has definitely got chocolate milk in it, I promise. So
yeah, it's all good. You know, certain points of the day you might consider adding something, but I have not.
There you go. It's not quite to that point yet. All right. Well, Marty, thanks so much. I really appreciate you taking time to walk folks through the concept of cruciates. I know it's a really big topic for a lot of people. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Have a great night, babe.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on the Marty and Laura Show. We're excited to bring you these unique, fun, fact-based conversations about pet health. From pro tips on selecting your new dog to what your cat's cough means and what you should do about it. We'll meet you wherever you are. in the car, on the treadmill, walking the dog. And we'll bring you a good laugh, a great story, and a bright idea every week. We hope you'll join us on social. Stop by the website to sign up for an extra tip of the week for your pet. While you're at it, do us a favor, please, and leave a review wherever you find your podcasts. The Marty and Laura Show is produced by Pure Dog Talk, Inc. Sound design and editing by Premium Audio Services.